So it's continuing with Christensen on 27 August 76.
Well, we have been monitoring, of course, all the time, the sun on, I think, 50 and 25 centimeters,
right,
I think it was.
And also 10 and 3 after 48.
Yes, that's right. Does well, that was us? Done by Heinemann. That's where Heinemann came
I
in.
I see.
He was on the 10 and 3, and we went through these results and thought we found quite a marked change in the base level at a certain stage. I don't think it was a thing of any great significance, and I don't know now even whether it was correct.
Yeah, but, this is the 30% drop or so in 1950 that you talked about, I see.
However, the real things came out of the other, the potential interferometer, and the first one was an estimate of the temperature of these regions that they were getting around about a million degrees.
Mm-hmm. Well, you had that even
we
back
had,
in your
yes, we,
observations.
Yes, right. And that's true, but we weren't so confident about them, but now we had these things sticking up, and we were thoroughly confident. And I can't remember whether this included the north-south. No, I don't think so. We also saw how long it took for these things to cross the solar disk, and from that got an estimate of the height above the photosphere. And also the sort of polar diagram of them to get a rough idea of what they looked like.
How directional the radiation was, you mean?
Yes, that's right. Well, now, while that was going on, I've always been sort of at least 50% engineer, so I was interested. I thought we'd better get another array going in the north-south. Oh yes, one of the things, of course, we found from this immediately was that it looked as though the sun was square. I mean, instead of the quiet sun looked like that, looked like a square wave, looked like limb brightening, and I thought, well, we must have a look in the north-south direction to see what's happening there too. So I built a second one, north-south. And using that too, of course, we got the one-dimensional thing in two directions. And then at that stage, I think it was the first paper came out of on the synthesis technique from Ryle's group.
The Blythe paper?
I think it was earlier than that. Wasn't there an earlier paper than that?
There was a two-dimensional thing that O'Brien did.
Ryle and von Berg? No, it was earlier than that. Ryle and von Berg,
was
it?
Not in aperture synthesis.
Oh, no, this wasn't a full one. This was, yes, it was. It was on the sun. A solar thing. It was the earliest of all of them, and I think it was before Blythe and long before.
Well, okay, well, Ryle and von Berg had a big paper in 47 in which they discussed their balancing receiver and so forth.
What was the name of this fellow? He's only appeared once in the literature,
well,
never again.
There's Stenier, who did a one-dimensional.
That's the one. No, it wasn't.
Pat O'Brien.
No, it was before. Stenier, that's right.
He did a variable spacing thing in one-dimensional.
That's right.
He didn't have phase, he had to
that's
assume
right.
circular
that's
symmetry.
Exactly, yes.
And then O'Brien did the same thing in two dimensions, about 54 he published.
That's right, yes. Well, by that time we'd done a rotational synthesis. That's right. We as soon as we got this one-dimensional one, I remember talking to Jim Roberts in mm-hmm. radio physics, and I said, does this thing work in two dimensions too? And I think by that time our discussions had gone away, a two-dimensional one had been produced. No, it hadn't. It was assuming circular symmetry. I think the English were assuming circular
right, that's
symmetry.
Right.
I said to these people, do you think that one could do it in two dimensions? And then someone said, well, the English are shifting around aerials to do this. You know, shifting the aerials.
Right, this was the work of Blythe.
That's right.
Going on then.
Yes. And I, at the same time, I thought, well, now I wonder whether you can do it without shifting your aerials around. And then I thought, damn it, the Cambridge boys, of course, can't steer their aerials. We can steer ours through 12 hours. So we'll follow the sun with both the north, south, and the east, west from morning till night, and we'll get our synthesis that way.
Let the Earth do the turn.
Yes, yeah. Let the Earth do it.
So you essentially came up with this idea independent of Ryle.
Oh, long, 10 years before. Not on aperture synthesis, but on the using the sun. Using the sun, yeah. Yes, because they had no errors for years.
Well, you mean using the Earth.
Using the sun, the Earth's rotation.
Right.
Earth to
well, to be fair about this, though, Ryle has tracked back in his notebooks in 54, he talks about the idea of doing a section of the North Polar area.
Oh, he's using
the Earth's orbit. So I would say that you both came up with it, and you used it on the Sun first before he used it on the...
Well, I think probably plenty of other people have similar ideas. I don't think there's anything very terrific in that, but we've certainly produced the first map by means of Earth rotation
synthesis. Using it, there's no doubt about that, right. Yeah.
And all these things, you know, it's very difficult.
Did that idea come along right with the same time as you were building the second arm of the
Yeah, house? That's right. At the time, well... It's very funny. This is a strange one, and this is one too that I don't like to say it because it's not against anyone, but it's just for the history of it. It was and it shouldn't be published ever. But Bernard Mills came along one morning and he looked at our two areas, you see, and he said, "Why don't you combine those two damn things at right angles?" And I said, "Well, if I could knew how to multiply the bloody things together, I could, but I don't." And the next day, Bernard came in and he said, "I do know how to multiply those things together because Ryle's done it." And so hence the Mills Cross came out exactly that.
You don't ever mention
that one.
Sure.
But you can see these things, all these things, people talking to each other. Mm-hmm. And there's no way of...
But now you're going back to 52 or 3 when the story you're telling now.
And that was about the time, you see, so that's why I said we would do it this way, by using the Earth's rotation. Because, this had impressed me, so that what I'm really getting at is, if you like to look at it, these, in radio physics at that time, people were talking to each other all the time. We used to have these sort of, the Americans call bull sessions, where mm-hmm. and thinking of every conceivable sort of aerial. And we just about invented every sort of possible to invent, I think, in those days. And it was really good
this
stuff.
Is throughout the 50s you're talking
about? Yeah, the early 50s. Particularly the early 50s.
Okay, well, that's an interesting point you bring up, because I get the impression from what I've been able to uncover, that there were several rather independent groups in radio physics.
Yours
and Bolton's and Mills.
That's quite true. Well, at that stage, Bernard was just coming into radio astronomy at that time. He'd been working on a linear accelerator.
I mean, for instance, Mills told me that there was very, very little contact between him and Bolton's group. They were doing their thinking.
No, they were rather at loggerheads, I must admit. I was in between. I got on quite well with both of them. So, but despite the fact that they are independent groups, we did have these sessions, these sort of ideas sessions, and
Were these a regularly held thing?
Every couple of months, I suppose we'd have one, a really good one that would last all day. And Joe Pawsey was one to stimulate that. He was a marvelous.
Well, I just made a note to ask you about him. You brought it up. Can you tell me, because I can't talk to him, unfortunately, can you tell me about him?
Well, Joe was a fellow with an enormous interest in science. Just a real fanatic, really, for science, and with enormous enthusiasm, and he infected everyone with his enthusiasm, and he didn't do any work himself. In fact, about the only paper he ever got his name on, I think, while I was there, apart from review papers, was one that I put one that we did, because I said to him, "Bugger it, Joe, you do half the work in this place and you never publish anything."
That was Christensen, Matheson,
that's
Quasi,
right,
and
Nature. And Joe was quite thrilled to have his name on, and yet he was the absolute keystone of the whole thing, but didn't publish anything.
That's right.
He just went from group to group, stimulating them, giving them ideas, criticising and stuff, mm-hmm. and which was a great shame, because he loved playing around, but he just didn't have time. He was a great fiddler. At this eclipse expedition that I described, he turned up, and I was working inside. I had the receiver. I just got it going. And Joe took to me in a big way, because I heard someone saying, "Oh, Christensen's lucky. His gear never works except when it's needed." Joe said, "I like lucky people." And Joe... I think you could say he's a very simple soul. He used to sometimes he was quite innocent too, but he'd floor a speaker, you know, the fellow turning up a great piece of astrophysics. And Joe would get up at the end and say quite innocently, and it was innocent, I mean, it wasn't just putting on, he'd say, I can't reconcile this with Ohm's law. Which would absolutely torpedo the whole.
Right.
Oh no, he was absolutely first class.
Yeah. And apparently not at all, I mean, very modest.
Very, very modest person, extremely modest.
Not caring for a great amount of
Very
publicity.
Simple. I've got a lovely story of Joe when he was staying with us in, when I was working in Holland in 1960. This wasn't long before Joe died. And Joe and his wife were staying with us in the Stellarach in London. Mm-hmm. And Joe was talking about Jan Oort. And he said, you know, Jan, we were staying in a part of Oort's house.
Right.
And he said, you know, Jan could never have done his work without Mika. Because Mika has just done everything. She protects him, she does this, that, and the other.
That's his wife.
Yes, yeah. Mika Oort. And he says, whereas you and I, Chris, just have to get along as best we can, and our two wives were there, you know. Real Joeism, that one.
Yeah.
Yeah, quite innocently, you wouldn't think it for a moment that there was anything offensive in such a statement.
Right. But anyway, it seems from what you're saying that his style really did sort of set the
yes.
tone.
It set the tone completely. I don't think the place would ever have been anything without Joe Corsi.
Mm-hmm. And was he also vital in terms of securing the necessary support?
Well, that was a peculiar one. He was a very, very unworldly fellow, and he was working with Bowen, who was actually the chief of the division.
Right.
That's Eddie Bowen.
Right.
And he, Bowen was the man who got the money. He was the sort of tough businessman. Joe was the rather academic scientist, and it was an excellent combination.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that was really the combination that was good. I doubt if Joe would have got much support on his own.
Yeah.
I think it was Bowen fighting for the money and
yeah, like you say, you need both.
Yes.
Now, when you got the two-dimensional sun,
yes,
with the Earth rotation synthesis, what did you find out?
Well, we did that only for the quiet sun. That had to be done for, getting the lower limits. There was a whole lot of records, and I superimposed them and took the lower end of that.
Right, right.
In fact, my son is a lecturer at Sussex. Told me the other day that he saw something called a Christensen plot, and I said, what the hell is a Christensen plot? He didn't know, but he wondered whether it was that type of plotting.
Making a lower envelope of...
He was most amused to see that. No, I haven't
I've never
seen
heard that term.
No, he struck it just the other day. However, that's quite irrelevant. But that was an essential part of this work, of course, taking the lower envelope to get the quiet sun.
Now, are you saying that you didn't have to worry about that before you went two-dimensional?
Well, I'd done that in one dimension. Now I've done it north, south, and east, west. But I wanted to get the real shape of the sun, so I combined all these lower things from the different angles.
I see.
The lower envelopes. So it wasn't a sort of one-day job, it was a many months job.
And did you realize before you made the antenna that this was going to be a problem? Or this was going to be
the main problem? Oh no, that was one of the problems. I wanted to get the quiet sun. That was one of the problems I wanted to...
Here's your 53 Nature article with the Christensen diagram, as it's called.
Plot sounds worse. That's worse than diagram. Sounds like a gunpowder plot or something.
Right.
Yes, you see, this is different in each scanning direction. And then putting those together and combining them in two dimensions, you see. I got this at different angles. Particularly what I did, the main stuff was really... At quiet sun period, this became almost like that, and then you could get the change during the one day.
In the quiet part of
yes,
the solar cycle.
Yes.
Yeah. Let me ask about Warburton. He was...
Joe, yes. Joe was a very active fellow who was working with me, and he didn't work with me for very long, but he got out into... he's now running some meteorological unit in the United States.
I see.
He's got right out of radio astronomy.
But he must have worked with you for several years.
Yes,
though.
He did. Yes.
And what was the relationship? Was he the engineer?
Well, he came. He came as a young graduate. He'd just graduated.
In what field?
Physics, I think. Yes, must have been physics. Yes, it was physics, right? I graduated in physics too.
And so was it basically your ideas, and it was a joint building
it
project?
It was really, yes, because
things?
Joe at that stage hadn't. But he was very helpful, on the other hand, on this two-dimensional synthesis, Earth rotation one.
In what?
Because I was away for some of that time, and he did a lot of that synthesis, and it was all done by hand. Something that would take us now, you know, or the computer. This was before electronic computers. So
sure.
We had tables of signs, and we just, cosines, and just moved them along. And I've still got the old pieces of paper. I did them. I think they were called someone or other strips.
Lipson Beaver strips.
That's
I've been
right.
told about them by the Cambridge group.
That's right. That's what they used.
They use those also.
Yeah.
I have here also the Australian Journal of Physics article in 53, in which you describe the aerial and then have the one-dimensional observations.
Yeah.
Let's just take a glance through here and see whether I had any points.
Oh yes, we did some colorization work too on that, I remember.
How did you measure polarization?
Well, this way here, we just put these alternate things were circularly polarized in opposite directions. With this arrangement, connecting the arrows.
Oh yes, shown in figure 4 of that paper, right. And there's your open line.
Yeah, feed lines, yeah.
Was this method of distribution, was that something unique? Also?
Yes, I think the whole thing was quite nothing of that sort of everything before, I guess.
Now here I've got a question. In paper 2, you talk about Stenier's work.
Yes.
Stenier found no sign of the limb brightening at 60 centimeters. The results obtained, however, must be treated with some reserve since the relative phases of the Fourier complex were not determined, and it was necessary, therefore, to assume that the one-dimensional brightness distribution was symmetrical.
That's right.
The published experimental curves show the presence of localized bright areas. And I'm wondering what you're referring to there, because all that I've ever found from Stenier is a short thing in nature.
Yes, well, what did I mean by that?
Maybe his thesis? Did you have a copy of that?
I must have had something which showed lumps on one side or another. I must have got hold of.
Yeah.
But I don't know what the pump is. I can't understand that. It's too long ago. But that was the Cambridge work. As a matter of fact, I got Martin Riles to change one of their papers on it. I've been at Cambridge at this time, and I said that it was quite a bit, a lot of rot, this not measuring phases and, drawing conclusions from it.
Oh, I see. You got him to change some
yes,
conclusions.
Yes, one of the papers, yes. I
remember that. Let's see if, before we go back.
Because, you see, we were the only ones, really, who could, in effect, measure phases.
Right.
Cambridge that time, they couldn't do it.
Right.
And whereas by making it a locked system, we could fix our phases and we knew exactly where we were.
Right.
So that's really what the difference was.
Now, on the two-dimensional syntheses, you apparently found a different amount of limb brightening at the equator than at the pole.
That's right, yes. Have you got that paper? Or?
I don't have that
no.
one, I'm afraid. That was 55
yes.
Australian Journal
That was
Physics.
One of the most important ones.
Why?
Well, that was the one really in which the you got this Earth rotational synthesis sort of put down, and it was also very important as the quiet sun. This had been suspected that there should be limb brightening, but it hadn't been suspected that it was it would only be a purely equatorial effect.
Mm.
There was something quite queer about the poles. This was quite a new sort of thing.
So you would vote if you had to say which one of your own papers is more important. You'd vote for this one rather than the first one. Describing the one-dimensional grading array.
Yes, and there was a fourth one too, I think, that was quite important. There were four, series of four of them. Those first two, I think, were just relatively unimportant compared with the next two, three and four.
Well, but of course the first one
well,
brings forth
we gave
the whole
principle.
Concept.
Yes,
yeah.
That's right.
Other thing.
All right, well, one, three and four were the important ones, I think.
Okay.
Two is not very important.
Let's see if there's anything else on the solar work before we go back to the hydrogen line business. Now, but what did you make of this business of a different amount of limb brightening?
Well, no one could make much about it because it was a matter of really threw it back on the optical boys to find out whether there was any difference between the corona around the poles and, mm-hmm. and the equator. And it was years later, well, there were two more solar papers that came out. One of them was a combined one with lots of astronomers. I don't know whether you've got that.
Yes,
you
I have that.
You have to go.
No, not yet. I'm just checking the time. Christensen et al. Was about 10 people.
Yeah, that's right.
In Arnold Astrophysique.
That's right. The other thing was the one that I did with Mathewson at, I think, Paris.
The Paris Symposium,
that's
right.
That's right. And that really summed the whole results up, I think. The fact that we'd now got a model, roughly, of what they were, that these bright regions were simply regions of enhanced density in the corona.
I think I have here 20,000 to 100,000 kilometer heights. And that you said they were similar in size and shape to the underlying plage and magnetic field region. So.
Well, now that fundamentally I think that still stands more or less.
Yeah.
And so that was the sort of conclusion to all this work.
But how did this come about? It seems to me if you're going to be studying the soiling invariant component, it's a matter of monitoring. So monitoring daily then with the...
Yes, we're monitoring daily, but this, yes, every day we took a picture and we watched these things travel across the sun. And we saw what happened to them and what happened when they came back again for a second rotation and all the rest of what their lifetime was, what their velocity was and roughly what their height was. We got all of that.
Right. What about this international paper that was published in 1960?
Well, this was an effort to get all the equipment, both optical and radio, that we had at our disposal together and see what came out of it.
And did anything?
Yes, I think it gave a fairly good model of what the...
I must admit I haven't looked at that paper.
Yes, well, that one was... It's nothing really staggering, but it did more or less set the... After that, people felt a bit easy that they knew what really was going on, what was the sort of general structure of that thing.
Okay, this also brings up the question of the general relationship between optical and radio solar astronomers.
Well,
when you first began...
Well, I had no relation with any of them, really, except with, in Australia, with, who was it?
Was it Harley Wood, perchance, or...?
No, it wasn't with Harley, it was with a chap who became Professor...
Allen, C.W.
Yes.
Allen.
Yes, Clay Allen, yes. Now, he was very interested in our work, and for a while he was doing a bit of radio astronomy himself.
And Monstromo, yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, I'd like to talk to him.
Yes, he's a good chap. Well, Clay Allen was the one who was very much interested in that work.
But he was primarily an optical astronomer, right?
Oh, yeah, completely, really.
Do you have any idea why it was that he, sort of a rarity in those days, saw that there would be some worthwhile...
Well, he was very interested in solar astronomy. Astronomy, though, at that stage was a solar observatory.
I see.
And Woolley was out to wreck it as a solar observatory. He said he'd have that name off that thing very quickly, which he did.
Yeah.
So that's why Allen left and took the chair in London. But Woolley definitely was just determined to close that thing down as an optical, as a solar observatory.
But as you went to meetings and so forth in the early 50s, did you feel yourself as an astronomer? Or is it more as a radio engineer?
No,
or what would you say?
Well, I don't know. We called ourselves radio astronomers, and we felt as though that's what we were, and we weren't either optical astronomers or engineers.
Right.
We were a really closed group.
But did you make efforts
at
meetings
to talk
with the optical solar
astronomers? Yes, but we found we didn't talk the same language, and we didn't in those days.
But even though you were giving them what we now would say would be vital information on the chromosphere, they weren't particularly interested.
Now, the only ones I knew who were really interested was that Swiss fellow, Waldmeier.
Waldmeier, yeah.
He was very interested. And who else?
Unseld had some interest.
Yes, he had, but I visited him once, and he was quite interested. But old Waldmeier was very interested. He was always getting out results. And...
Do you know if he's still alive, by the way?
I haven't seen him. he usually comes to these. And the other one, of course, was Newkirk. He was a, you know, one of the younger generation, but he was very interested in the radio. Gordon Newkirk.
And where was he at that time?
What was it, Boulder or Colorado, one of those places. I think he's at high altitude level.
Right.
So we knew him and we were, you know, very friendly with him. The work, of course, Paul Wilde's work in the Sun was going on at the same time as this, but his was, it was a complete split between the Quiet Sun, slowly varying component group, which was mine, and the other, the Paul's, which was the Spurs.
I see. It is. Was it, that sort of happened accidentally?
Just, no, it just happened that he was started off to do this work with MacCready, and on the building this equipment for the spectrograph, and he was working at a different frequency and in a different place, so it wasn't very much coming.
Okay, that pretty well covers the observations you've made in Australia, but there's several other things that I wanted to talk to you about.
Well, by the way, during that process, I spent a year at the Institut d'Astrophysique in
France. Well, this is
the
sort of thing, I mean...
And I did one...
Which year was that?
Oh, that was 54. And I did a... helped Lafleur. I think I got one joint paper there.
That's right.
Lafleur, something, Kupiak.
About the Swedish...
That's right. But I did the French end. They went off to Sweden. And I did the one at Medellin.
That was partial
of the observation at Medellin.
It was partial there.
Yeah.
I see.
It was such a terrible... I can remember very well because it was a receiver with such a terrible temperature coefficient that I had a piece of string on the door, and it was an old Birchborg thing, and I kept it to within half a degree. I had a thermometer on the hanging onto the front of the receiver, and I kept it to within half a degree by, as the temperature went down slightly, I'd close the door and then open the door and so on. Because there are big temperature changes during an eclipse.
Normally you wouldn't have to worry about it if it'd been a little bit more temperature stable.
That's right. Yeah.
What was the purpose of spending a year in France?
Well, I'd never been away from Australia, and I just wanted to go away, and France appealed to me. I've always done that. Whenever I've gone away on sabbatical, I've always gone to a place where they didn't speak English.
Yeah.
I had a year in France and a year in... Oh, I've spent about 3.5 years in Holland, and had a year in China.
Okay, well, I want to talk to you about both those, but let me just ask you about your impression of what was going on in the French group in 54.
Well, Lafleur was working completely on his own, and the other group was Denis Steinberg, Blum, and so on.
Now, I've talked to them about how they see the development, but I'm interested in your outside opinion.
Well, they were really the better group. I mean, they were the up-and-coming group.
As opposed to Lafleur, you mean?
Yes. Yeah. Lafleur was a first-class engineer, but somehow or other he didn't get on with the others. And being on his own, it was a... Well, he didn't ever get off the ground.
But... It's my perhaps biased opinion that French radio astronomy, which was almost purely solar until 1960, never really quite made it.
Not compared with some of the other countries, that's right. Compared with the English and the United States and Australia, they were all. I don't know why, because their people were very brilliant people, I thought.
Maybe they never had tremendous funding.
I don't know, partly that, I think. I don't know. And Denise is a very bright fellow.
Okay, that was one visit, but to keep things chronological, let's go back to the hydrogen line first. How did you get involved with that?
Well, we had, Joe Pawsey had a letter, I think, from Purcell, and he said that they'd discovered this, and of course old Joe went rushing around madly around the apartment and said that Purcell has found this, and he also said we might like to have a go at... So Heinemann and I started off independently with our equipment to do it, and then we decided to pull it because we were both having trouble, but complementary troubles. So,
could you say what they were?
Oh, he had his front end working and I had the back end or something. I can't remember. Something like that. And so I said, we said, well, we might as well pull it because it looks as though it worked that way. So we put it together and God, it was the most terrible piece of equipment I've ever seen in all my life. We did the frequency switching by, we had on the floor an old wartime radar oscillator and we just periodically switched a lump of resistance across it, which pulled the frequency, and it was an absolute monster. And we spent, I can remember working day and night on that. And the first time I saw the line, I'd given it up. I thought gear would never work. And then I went to sleep and then came back and there was a beautiful curve sitting up on it. And after that, we kept going. And
now, how long did it take you to slap together this?
It took us about a month to get the thing working, which was really very... Because actually, Ewan came out. He said he came out to the ERSI meeting. No, it couldn't have been the ERSI meeting. When was this?
Well, the ERSI meeting was summer 52.
Yes, and when was the hydrogen line?
The hydrogen line was June... Your thing was June or July 51.
That's right. Well, it was then. Ewan came out. He said he had to come out to see how these goddamned Australians did in 3 weeks what took him 18 right. months to do. And when he saw the gear, he just about passed out. Just junk lying all over the room and on the floor. And anyway, we did something that hadn't been done before. You see, Jan Ort at this stage. Ewan had provided something, had got just really found the thing with a fixed horn sticking out the window. Right. And the people at Leiden had done something, but they had only done two positions or something like that. I can't
That's
remember
right.
how it was. So we decided we'd do the whole sky as we could see. And I sent it to, sent our first map to Jan Ort. And he was very pleased with this. I've got his letter. He took it all around the world with him at that stage. And but we got two. We got a couple of things that looked like spiral arms.
Mm-hmm.
So that we said, this is the first evidence. We thought we had the first evidence that we were living, radio evidence that we were living in a spiral galaxy.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember meeting, I think it must have been that same ERSI meeting, Morgan.
Yeah, yeah.
He came to Australia. No, it couldn't have been ERSI. I met him somehow or other. And he was, of course, very interested because he'd been doing the optical stuff
right,
too.
Right, right. It's rather interesting that the optical came up at the same
That's
time
right,
as the hydrogen.
Exactly.
Was the entire survey done with this same bit of equipment?
Yes, yes.
I see.
Yeah, same bit. It was a miracle we ever got anything out of that junk. It was really incredibly awful.
Why were there two efforts originally? It seemed to make sense to pull you from the beginning, or was
well,
this idea
I don't
that
know. You
one
see,
of them will succeed?
It was, as you say, rather independent groups. We just two lots went flying into the back room to try and build some equipment to look for it. And Joe rather encouraged it, I think, because he liked to have two lots of people in case one lot succeeded and one didn't.
Oh yeah, okay.
So he wanted two strings to his bow, I think, and so he didn't. But then we. We had enough sense to when it came to the point.
Hyman was in which group then?
He was working with a group of Piddington and
well,
Minette.
Another group that I have.
Piddington
mentioned.
And Minette, yeah. Yes, they were sticking to the centimeter wavelength stuff.
In the galactic plane.
Yes, all sorts.
Yeah, I haven't talked to either of them, but I plan to. Now about this H1 survey, it strikes me as interesting that your approach was different as you. Well, you haven't actually said that. Was different from both Harvard and Leiden in that you presented a contour map of brightness temperature.
Yeah, just
in the sky.
Peak brightness, yes.
Right,
peak
and sort of analogous to how one would do continuum radiation.
That's right, yeah.
And you talked about what could make the variation in the brightness. You said, well, according to this abstract I have here, that it could be due to differing line widths. You really have the same amount of hydrogen, but it's getting spread out. Or it could be due to different intensity of the hydrogen.
That's right, different sort of temperatures and things.
Thicknesses,
probably optical depth.
Well, you said that perhaps associated with continuum radiation. I think the idea may have been, well, if it's hotter in the continuum, that
it might be
maybe
hotter
the,
in
and a hydrogen or something like this.
Yeah, could have been. I can't remember. We were just flapping around the dark.
Right. You undoubtedly were not aware of Wart's concepts and all this sort of thing.
At
you
all.
Know. Yeah.
I just come in out of the dark, really. And,
right.
And looked at it. And But it was a useful map because for many, many years, radio astronomers used that map to find where the hydrogen was.
For the southern sky.
That's right. And even some of the northern ones, because Weaver told me they used it for years.
I see.
Yeah. Huh.
Now, how long did it take to make this whole survey?
Well, we got the thing going at about 2 months after we started, and I guess it must have taken about 4 or 5 months.
Hmm.
We were just about dead at the end of it, I remember that. We had no sleep for months.
And the idea of the spiral structure, did that come from having seen Morgan and...
No, we didn't know anything about that. We didn't read any astronomical.
So how did that come about?
Well, it just looked like two things like that looked like a spiral structure. You see, we got on our map two continuous...
Two things at different places on the sky.
Yeah, two long arcs around the Earth. We found two long arcs.
I see what you're saying. But how did you come up with, in the abstract, it says you have distances of 1 in 4 kiloparsecs from the Sun. How did you deduce those?
Oh, just from their frequency and the rotation. We knew as much of that, yes. We knew about rotation and orts. Yes, I'm sorry. We knew the elements, only the elements.
Okay.
Oh, yes, I'm sorry. I shouldn't have implied that we didn't know what, you know, rotation was. We didn't know that.
Yeah. Well, of course, Ort had talked about that a little bit in the Nature article. Awesome. Well, that finishes the formal papers, but now I'd also like to ask you about the years you spent in Holland, in particular about the early years of the Benelux Cross.
Yes, by the way, there is some earlier, there's this cross grading too stuff. That was. You haven't got onto that.
Well? My bibliography, I thought, was complete through 60. When would this be?
Oh, perhaps we didn't publish the main paper. No, when did we? Oh, yes, we must have. On the, we published quite a bit on the, from the IEEE, the Institution of Electrical Engineers. You'll find a big article on the cross grading interferometer. Or something.
Right, but I think that was 63 or 4, that special issue.
Was it? Oh, no, this was the Institution of Electrical Engineers, not the British one. I'm sure it must have been then because, well, the thing is we did start using this in 54, and I'm quite sure we must have written it up before 60.
Oh, yes. Oh.
I'm sorry, 50, we started using it, the first maps were 57.
Yeah.
57.
Oh, no, there are lots of papers on write-ups of, you had one in the special issue of the Proceedings of the IRE in 58 on radio astronomy, and you had one in the IRE Australia in 59. I haven't mentioned those explicitly because we've been talking about.
Well, this is a different bit of equipment, you see.
Well, maybe I'm not sure what you're referring to. Can you be more explicit?
This is going to FLIRS when we get to there, to 56, 57. I decided to build another antenna, but a cross one this time. You see, at Potts Hill we had this a north, south, and an east, west interferometer. Okay, each 6 foot diameter.
Right,
dishes.
Right.
Then I thought we should be producing daily maps of the Sun, two dimensional maps of the Sun.
Okay, I didn't realize that there were two.
Oh, yes, this was quite a different instrument.
Okay, well,
quite
tell
a different
me about
principle.
This then.
And so now I had got one two dimensional thing from the using Earth's rotational synthesis, but that's quite unsuited to daily maps of the Sun. For one thing, the Sun rotates during the day, so that the Sun is not a good thing for doing Earth rotational synthesis. And I looked around and I thought, now the best thing is to combine the grating with the cross. In fact, as I said to Mills once, it went the other way really, that the cross came out of the grating rather than the vice versa, you see. But so I built a cross out at FLIRS, and it was bigger, and the elements were much bigger.
Single dishes, still.
Single dishes, but I mean, they were 20 feet in diameter instead of 6 feet, you see. And it was longer, and then combined that with the, or steered one. So you had two sets of grating, just riding like that. And then you used it as a cross, so each of those became a point. And steered one of them by putting in quite an elaborate arrangement.
This is all coming back to me now. That's very different. Yes. With the Potts Hill thing, all you were doing was two separate one-dimensional
scans. That's right, exactly.
Scans.
And you didn't steer anything, you didn't do anything. So this was a steering one. And now this one produced the first daily maps of the sun. And we produced our first in 57, and that's still doing it.
It's the same array, it's still
but we're using it for different things now, but it's
is this the same array that's being used for 20th century continuum on galaxies and stuff?
Yeah, it's part of it. It forms part of this other new system.
I see.
You see, we're using the same array for different purposes.
I see. And this was also the basis of the cross that Bracewell built.
That's right. He got his going a few years later. Well, Braun, of course, was with us in Sydney.
But not in your group specifically, was he?
Well, no, he was working in the same room.
Yeah.
Ron and Mills and I shared the same room.
I see.
So we were very close together.
Yeah.
And so that Ron built one at 10 centimeters and we built one at 21.
And you also had, what was his idea that the different longitude would also give you?
Well, he was really wondering what to do when he went to Stanford, and we were only at the stage of, we'd been talking about this, you see, at the place, and with Ron and so on, and he'd been entering into the discussions, so that when he decided to go, and we decided roughly the same time to build this in Sydney, got Joe Causey's permission, and Ron left and decided to build one there, so it all came out of the same group.
Right, that was
Don Matthewson who wrote the papers here.
Excuse me. So that ends this portion of the interview with Christensen. More to come later on 27th August 76, and that's the end of this side of the tape also.